Did you know that research has been carried out to discover ways of controlling your every thought and desire? In a moment, what you will hear will both shock and horrify you. We've got Eldon Taylor, Mind Programming, on Coast to Coast AM. Eldon Taylor has been researching the power of the mind for the past 25-plus years and is considered to be an expert in the area of hypnosis and subliminal communication for over 10 years. Eldon specializes in criminalistics, where he supervised and conducted investigations and testing to detect deception. President Director of the Progressive Awareness Research, Inc. And here he is back on Coast to Coast after a pretty long hiatus, Eldon, huh?
Yes, I think about 10 years.
My God, where have you been in 10 years?
Continuing the research and missing Coast to Coast.
Well, I'm glad you're back. This is fascinating work. You've got to tell me and everybody else listening, what led you into this direction? Not everybody wakes up and starts to go into research the human mind the way you have.
But, you know, for all intent and purposes, I look at my life and I see a straight line. Since I was a child, I have been interested in why people do what people do. And, of course, as you said in the introduction, I found myself at a point where I was practicing criminalistics, and that included lie detection testing, forensic hypnosis, investigations, and so forth. And I would, you know, encounter situations where, for the life of me, it was very difficult to understand why people made the choices that they made. I guess, you know, I'd have to harken back to 1984 when we set a study in motion out at the Utah State Prison to look at why inmates were inmates. I mean, you could have two brothers, one that turned out to be a surgeon working in the local hospital, another who was a recidivist, a third-time offender, violent criminal. And we ran some extensive tests and came away with no big surprises. You know, we had scores, high scores, in what's known as self-alienation and social alienation. In other words, we had a population that had low self-esteem, and they exacted that against society. If I'm not worth anything, you're worth less. Kind of compensation.
Yeah.
But when we got right into talking to them one-on-one, for setting off the psychometrics, discovered that they had this ability to displace responsibility, and that ability we just call blame. That was a real turning point for me. As I began to look down that path, and maybe in the next 3 hours we'll pursue that, but as I began to look down that path, what I saw was what culminated in the book Mind Programming, a process by which an individual gives up their authentic self in favor of a rehearsed self, a practiced self, a self that they have taken on from peers, from the media, from various forms of mind influence, and thus the book Mind Programming. Because my intent there was, although I do spend some time looking at covert, surreptitious means that were done by the government. So my intent there was really to say, wake up, you know. I thought that maybe I could even retitle the book, call it something like, What Do I Believe, Why, and Who Am I After All? But, you know, it probably have a whole lot less appeal.
Yeah, well, Mind Programming tells it all. I guess you could also have said, you know, the mind is a sponge, because it seems like people who are brainwashed, and I guess we're all bombarded, they let this happen. Can they fight it? Can they stop it?
Well, the answer to that is yes. But to do that, they have to ask the big question. And that big question is, who am I? I mean, you know, yeah. I just came back from a seminar, hundreds of people, and you can ask the audience, when was the last time you had an original thought, a truly original thought? Indeed, let's just take that a little bit further. I want you to look at yourself, you know, self-examination, and tell me what there is about you that is not copied from something.
That's me?
Yeah, anybody.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you
and
one.
I don't mean to direct that at you.
No,
that
let me tell you
that I do put to people in seminars. Yes, sir.
Let me tell you what we did, and you tell me if this if fits into that scheme, because I'm very proud of this. You know, in addition to working on Coast to Coast Monday through Friday, I do the first Sunday of every month. And I was kicking an idea around with my producer, Tom, and, you know, we came up with an idea of highlighting emerging artists, people. We run bumper songs between breaks, and you've heard that, Elton.
Right. Uh-huh.
But to give these people an opportunity who never get a chance to play their hard-earned work, their music, on radio stations. They just it's just going to be very difficult for them to do it.
Right.
And unlike American Idol, where there's really one winner, everybody that gets a bumper song on this program, I think, is a winner. So we decided we're going to take these emerging artists, these folks in North America who are out there, who love music, who've produced CDs, and they do it because they love it, and we're going to start playing them as bumper songs on that first Sunday. And I've got to tell you, the response has been absolutely incredible. I'd like to say that's an original idea. I don't think anybody else is doing that.
No, and I would concur with you. That is a great idea. But in order for you to get that idea, and you correct me, I mean, I don't want to, you know, read your mind over the radio.
Though you're probably doing it.
But in order for you to do that, you had to step back and take a position that's uncommon. It's a position we think of as service. You know, what is it that I can do that is going to empower or to assist or to aid another? You had to move from the I, me orientation. That orientation, Thomas Hobbes tells us, is all about gain for the purpose of defense. That is, we're so fearful that we have to wrestle for power in order to stave off our fears. That selfish sense of individual that we see so much of today, that lack of civility. You had to step away from that, George.
Yes.
And you had to think conversely. You had to flip the model upside down and say, okay, what is it that I can do to give back? What is it I can do to serve? And I'd like to think, and you also correct me if I'm wrong, that when you think about that, when you put your head on the pillow at night, you get a warm, fuzzy feeling. You feel good. You feel that your life makes a difference.
Yes, and you also feel as if you're helping your fellow man.
Yeah, well, and I think that's why you feel that your life makes a difference. See, what I discovered with these inmates was, to the precise extent that they displaced responsibility, the precise extent that they blamed everybody, they literally tied themselves up. Meaning, you know, the standard answer would be something like, "Ah, but for the grace of God, there go you." I mean, what would you do? I mean, my daddy was an alcoholic. My mommy was a prostitute. The neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. And most of the stories we heard were very exaggerated. They were totally false in many instances. But the mechanism of displacing that responsibility meant that they didn't need to do anything about it. Indeed, they really couldn't do anything about it. So as opposed to taking responsibility for all of their actions or looking at what they might do in the world that would, as you just did, benefit, what they were looking at is how they got even. And we have almost this unwritten moray in our society that it's okay to get evener. And it really never has been. So you had to convolute the model, and that's part of what I try to tell people in mind programming. You have to step out of this frame of mind. May I share a story with you?
Absolutely.
Short story. Okay. I think this illustrates what we're trying to talk about, because it illustrates how easily we're confused in our day-to-day choices. So, you know, the story, imagine that you're walking down the street in a beautiful city. It's a new city to you. Maybe it's London. Maybe it's New York. You've never been there. It's a glorious day. You've always wanted to go there. Sun's shining. You're on the sidewalk. You're in a really expensive, nice area. You're passing under high-rise condos, and from the third-floor balcony, a flower pot falls. Strikes you on the head, falls to the sidewalk, charred, scatter about. you have some choices. Now, I tell this story to thousands of people, and here are the three that I always get. The first one is, you know, I'm going to take this pot, these broken pieces, I'm taking it up to that third floor, and I'm putting them you know where.
Yep.
Of course, if you get up there and it's the lineman for the New York Giants, maybe you change your mind.
Kind of shuffle back a little bit.
You know, the second one is, I'm going to sue this guy. You know, I mean, hey, after all, they should know better than this. What if it was a baby passing underneath?
Uh-huh.
You know, this could be whiplash, da-da-da.
Let's teach him a lesson.
Yeah. And hey, you know, I was talking to a radio host. I have to add this one in Detroit not long ago, and he said, I'm going to do number one and number two.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And, you know, and the third one is, well, I'm going to be metaphysical. You know, I'm just not going to let this ruin my day. I'm just going to ignore it. I mean, it's an abrasion, a little bump. It bothers me some. But, you know, I'm going to go on having a great day, and that's the end of this. And we can look at that and say that's a form of denial, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So that's true. Then you ask the audience, and what else is it you would do? And you all, I always get these blank looks, these blank stares, and it's, well, like what? Is there something else that you might do? Well, maybe you pick up the flower, take it to the florist, repot it.
Save it.
Now, maybe you take it home and keep it. That'd be okay. But maybe even you take it back to the owner. You know, you knock on their door, hey, your flower fell, hit me on the head. You probably ought to be a little more careful with it. But I didn't want it to die, so I repotted it.
And
I
here
it
is.
The pot. Now, of all those things, when you get to the end of the day, you put your head on the pillow, which one's going to make you feel the best?
Of course, the one where you give him the pot with the little flower in
it. Now, here's the secret.
It should.
Yeah, it should, because what happens when you do that is... Your body, I mean, just selfishly, okay? Your body is bathed with all these wonderful neurochemicals. Those chemicals that are the natural endorphins that just make us feel good. And our bodies essentially have two budgets analogous to a government. We have a budget for defense. We have a budget for growth. So I have the body in the budget for growth. If I put the body in the budget for defense, well, I interrupt the optimal operation of my ANS, my immune, my endocrine. Next thing I know, I'm vulnerable for this, that, and the other, and I'm sick. So just from a selfish standpoint, if we were to think of it only that way, changing slightly how we look at life can make a huge difference in what we realize our lives to be.
Good point. Now, but that's with an individual. Your work with mind programming tells us that there are others out there trying to bombard us, trying to change us, and manipulate us.
You know, that's a fact, and there's no way we're going to get away from that. We, you know, if you really look at the subject, brainwashing, mind programming, you'll find skeptical definitions that say enculturation, processes is not mind programming. However, if you look at the influence of enculturation processes, it clearly is mind programming. Most of us are raised in what I think of as a no-don't syndrome. We don't have a rite of passage, and we're told we're not old enough or we're not smart enough or you know, our peers will tell us that we're stupid, we're ugly, we're fat, we're skinny. Our laugh is peculiar, our hair is. We've all heard all these stories. Well, when we take that aboard, it's painful. And so what we do psychologically is develop adaptive mechanisms, defense strategies to avoid that pain and to maximize our pleasure in life. And sometimes they're compensatory. What we don't do is come to a point where we ever look at them and graduate from them. So those mechanisms that we may employ when we're children, we take completely through our life. And often they self-sabotage us. So to me, it begins there. But it gets a whole lot more malevolent. We can have parents that have the best intent, and we can have parents whose intent is, well, I'll just say confused. But it the net result is it's very hurtful. But then we also have those people that just totally want to manipulate us, you know? Somebody the other day asked me, George, they said, how long has there been an overt effort to really control our minds, discounting mom and dad?
I would say since we've had humans on this planet.
Yeah, and that's the answer. But, you know, 80 years ago, we got really sophisticated about it because along came Sigmund Freud, and what most people don't recognize is Freud had a nephew, and the nephew probably has impacted us more than Sigmund Freud because the nephew saw these unconscious mechanisms that his uncle called out and thought, what could I employ to manipulate a person unconsciously, subconsciously? Man's name was Edward Bernays, and, you know, we know him today as the father of propaganda.
Yes.
And, you know, it was Bernays that said it was the conscious and intelligent manipulation of the habits and opinions of the masses that was the duty of the elite in a democratic society. Indeed, I think his quote went something like, we have to manipulate them or you won't be able to govern them. We have to control and mold their minds, their tastes, and give them the ideas they're going to have. Otherwise, we won't be able to conduct a social society. We won't be able to have ethical thinking, et cetera. So what Bernays set out to do, and that paraphrase is from his book Propaganda, what he set out to do was sophisticate marketing. And to do that, scientific marketing, he employed some sophisticated biofeedback means. And we began to look at how the body responded to questions, how the body responded to stimuli. Well, today that's known as neuromarketing, and neuromarketing incorporates the use of functional magnetic resonance imaging, positron emission tomography. It's very, very sophisticated. And we know as a case in point, as a result of utilizing that technology, that the warning on a cigarette pack, the Surgeon General's warning on a cigarette pack, actually excites precisely the same area in the brain, the nucleus accumbens, that is excited due to addictions.
And due to addictions, right.
So what we have is that is probably the best advertisement that tobacco companies could run, because when a smoker sees it, they have to have a cigarette.
It's almost like telling your kid, don't do it. They end up doing it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, don't touch wet paint. We've all seen that.
Exactly. And let me ask you this too, Eldon, that in the old days when they would behead some criminal in a public square and everybody would be gathered around to see this horrifying event, they, of course, took care of the criminal. But weren't they also sending a message to the population, don't get out of control here, folks?
Well, I think that's true. There's no question about that. But there's also a lot to be said about what that kind of violence does. Let me bring that around to our era.
All right.
If we look at the media today and we compare the media to, say, 1950, there's a shocking difference by way of the level of stimulation that is made available, both in violent nature and its sexual content.
And technology as well.
And technology, absolutely. And the technology is key because, as you know, you can do lots of things with the speed of the frames and the movie, mm-hmm. and so forth. So, and technology. Well, what we have now is a time when, if I look back to the 50s, I might take my gun to school and in seventh period go out with a teacher and we might actually all shoot together. Today,
the BB gun, you mean?
Yeah, well, even a .22. But today,
really?
you know, that would, I mean, you're going to have a SWAT team there.
You're
in a
done.
Minute.
You're arrested, you're expelled, and they've arrested you. You're gone.
That's right.
Eldon, we're going to take this quick break and we're going to come right back with you. This is fascinating. Mind programming. Eldon Taylor, our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM. You can sign up for StreamLink by going to coasttocoastam.com, get podcasts and downloads, and soon you'll be able to get more downloads of past programs. StreamLink from Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Eldon Taylor, our guest, Mind Programming. Eldon, we'll talk about some more of these analogies of why people get their minds programmed and why they do it. But let me pick your brain for just a moment.
Okay.
During this current economic mess we're in, I think one of the major factors for the downturn is the public's perception of defeat. So, you know, General Motors, for example, quarterly revenues down 47% because people said, I'm not going to buy these cars. They may not be in business. I'm not going to have a warranty. And this perception just multiplied and multiplied. If people were just calm, or if government made it seem calm, I think people would have gotten the economy going a little better. It's not to say the greed with the mortgage business and everything else contributed. But what happened to the public mind in terms of collectively putting us in a position we're in now?
Okay. You know, first of all, I totally concur with your analysis. I mean, we hear that this is a subprime collapse, or a collapse due to subprime loans, and they may well have a good deal to do with the housing market. But we really have a consumer confidence problem more than we have anything else.
Yes.
And it is, you know, that lack of consumer confidence has been fed by the news cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That news cycle is there 24/7, searching for something that is noteworthy, and almost always that tends to be the sensational, the fearful, et cetera. So, you know, we live in a day and age where a hiccup is not a hiccup anymore. You know, it's a major event. And this event, not unlike any other kind of mass hysteria, has for all intent and purposes convinced the American people that we may be entering the Great Depression of our time. Now, it's only been recently that we start seeing some news and some forecasters are saying, you know, I think we've hit the bottom, we're turning the corner, we're not going to have a major depression. But if you harken back just 3 months ago, that was the forecast. We had a newly elected president that was in front of us on a pretty regular basis telling us this was the worst economic times of our time.
Yes.
Now, I hate to get political. I don't want to get political. But when you hear from White House executives words like this is too good a crisis to pass up, and you understand that that basically is the signal that now is the time for us to do all the things that we want to do,
mm-hmm.
Because we can justify that in the name of crisis. You have to look at that as an informed citizen and say there's more to this than what the general public is paying attention to. But then the general public doesn't pay attention. That's part of the problem, George. We have a society that is filled with the need for stimulation. You know, before we went to break, you'd asked me about public execution.
Right. Let's go to that.
And I said, if we just brought that into today, and we look at the difference between 1950 and today, what we can see is a clear pattern. And the pattern that emerges is this. The media, more than anyone, but all forms of our entertainment, all forms of even our education, is intent on capturing our attention. In order to do that, it has to deliver something that piques an arousal, causes an arousal. That level of stimulation must increase systematically because as we receive more and more stimuli, our threshold of arousal raises, requiring even more stimuli. So a Marilyn Monroe passing over some air vent and having her skirt fly in the air is about as scintillating as closing your thumb in a car door today. It just doesn't do it.
That's a good point.
So what happens, and I have observed this in every area. What happens, and has happened in our country is we've kind of adapted a fifth drive. You know, I call it that in mind programming because that's what we see it. You know, in Psych 101, as you remember, you're taught there are four drives: fight, flight, feeding, and propagation of the species. Well, the fifth drive is more. I want more. I want more money. I want more power. I want more cars. I want more women. I want more men.
More everything.
And if you look at young children today, everything to them is more. There's never such a thing as enough.
And keeping up. They come home from school and they've got this pressure. They've got to have the right tennis shoes. They've got to have this and that.
That's exactly right. And all of that has been sold to us. And what we're pursuing is what? I mean, when you get right down to it, what is this stuff? You know, in the end, it's stuff. It's just stuff. We have inauthenticated ourselves, given ourselves over to some counterfeit being that we think of as ourselves, because we have taken on the pursuit of all this stuff that everybody tells us we have to have in order to be happy. We have to have in order to be whole. We have to have, and so what we see in this current consumer confidence collapse, if you will, is this fear. And of course, you know, a lot of people don't understand that advertisers want to sell you fear just as much as everybody else does, because there's great opportunities in it. If I can sell you fear, I can sell you a solution. But we have this fear that maybe all the good times are going away, and that fear has forced, if you will, a sort of hysteria, and that. It isn't a lot different than this. In my book, I recount how groups behave, and we do behave collectively in groups. And I tell several, you know, actual incidents, but the one that comes to my mind is the school teacher who smells gasoline around a 50-gallon drum that has, like, a skull and bones indicating that it might be radioactive.
Yeah, okay.
Okay? And immediately, she's sure that this is something left over from the Second World War, it's in the basement, you know, da-da-da. She reacts to it. Her body breaks out. She tells everybody what it is. There's over 100 people from that school in the hospital that evening, all with the same symptoms.
Yeah.
But this is a 50-gallon drum of water, as it turns out. You see,
it's like the placebo.
You remember restless leg syndrome?
Yep.
When the patent was there, and it was all over TV, and this is documented, the incident of restless leg syndrome just blew through the roof. Take it off of television, it once again disappeared.
Why does the mind work collectively, then?
Well, you know,
What happened to the individual?
I think what happens, first of all, is we've given ourselves over, but to look at that, you have to digress and have to say, what is it that we trust in the world? Well, let's see. We trust our senses, but they're not all that reliable. And we could get into that if you want. I can show you that your senses will betray you as often as not. We trust authority, you know, the advice, the television ads, the doctor. In fact, there's new research that shows when the authority is there, if we're actually scanning your brain, the area of the brain that makes choices, makes decisions, shuts down, just turns off.
And accepts, right?
That's right. I mean, it literally, you're looking at an area of the brain that is lit up, if you will, and it goes dark. All right?
That's dangerous.
Oh, no kidding. And then we have all these really implicit assumptions, biases, and contexts that are so built in. You know, one of my favorite stories there is one Jesse Jackson tells. Reverend Jesse Jackson admits to his chagrin that he understands that his own biases still sway him. And he explains that this way. He remembers walking back to a hotel. It's after dark. He hears footsteps approaching from behind. They're coming rapidly and heavy. He turns quickly because he's frightened.
Sure.
And he's relieved. It's a white man.
Jeez.
Now, that is quite a bias for a Jesse Jackson to have. And what we know is we all have these biases. In fact, you can go, your listening audience can get on the internet, go out there. The Harvard implicit bias tests are available, and you can look at all the different biases, whether they're age or race or sex et cetera. But we all have those. And then we have the context framing. We don't even stop to think that we're unable to think. We're limited in our thinking. You know, you hear think out of the box, but hey, listen, try this, you know? A couple of stories.
Be edgy. People need to be edgy. Go ahead with the stories.
Yeah. Somebody comes to your door. It's 9 o'clock at night. You're still home. You're not doing coast to coast. Somebody you know, George, they knock on your door. They say, you know, look, I'm in a scavenger hunt. If you've got a 3x7 piece of wood, I can win $10,000. You think, I haven't got a wood pile or anything. Hey, I'll split it with you if you've got that. Gee, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And you close your 3x7 wood door. We get trapped in how we think. Here's one I really love. You and I are doing the radio right now. You think of the saliva in your mouth. Think of how good it is to have it, because if it's, you know, we're not talking if we go dry.
I have foamed once in a while, though.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah, I do that.
All right. But it tastes good, feels good. Ask the listening audience. Think about it. Roll it around in your mouth.
No. Stop. You're killing
me. I want you to imagine you just have a clear shot glass, and you're just going to spit that saliva into that shot glass, okay? Got it in the glass? Now I want you to imagine, knock it back. Just drink it back down. Something changes, doesn't it?
You need help, Elton.
When it's in your mouth, it's good. When it's in that shot glass, separated by a tenth of a second, it's vile.
It's because you can see it.
Why? Because you can see it?
Well, that's one reason.
I don't know that I would accept that, George. We have a context.
We have a perception,
of
what it is.
And those perceptions frame our every judgment, our every decision, our every thought. And they've been voiced it on us.
And some people have good perceptions, others don't, right?
That's correct. No question about that. But in order to get good perception, you have to become responsible enough to train yourself to get good perceptions.
Sure.
And even at that, then you have to understand that we believe that we're making our choices. We believe that consciously we're making our decisions. But the research shows us, has shown us since the mid-50s, and it's been verified over and over again, but Benjamin Libet originally did this work, shows us that areas of the unconscious become excited before we make a motor movement or we say a word. In other words, if we're making a choice, we've already made it in the unconscious. And the unconscious is now going to put it forward for us. And further, with respect to that, we know that I can prime you in a way. Let's say I can put the word angry over a face of an individual I'm going to introduce you to. Now, I'm going to flash this word angry, or I'm going to put a big frown over this face, but I'm going to do it with a tachyscope so that it's subliminal. It's 1/300th of a second. You're not even going to know that it's there. I'm going to give you a half a dozen of these exposures, and then I'm going to introduce you to the person. And when I do, you're not going to like them. You're going to report to me that, nah, you just weren't comfortable with them. But you're going to make up a reason for why.
You have no idea, but you make them up.
You have no idea, but you have to make up a reason. You can't just say to me, well, I have no idea why I didn't like him. Well, you know, he looked like my uncle, and I had a bad... You're going to make up a reason for the decision that you made. Now, when you add all of that together, and we're just getting in the beginning of this, you can already see how important it is to stop and come back and start peeling off some layers, looking at who am I really? You know, what am I here for? What is it I want out of life? What are my real possibilities and potentials? And until and unless we do that, we go through life asleep.
That's pretty good. That is pretty good. Now, these people who are trying to manipulate and control us Have they studied this? Is there a science behind it? Or are they just rolling the dice?
No. Billions and billions of dollars. Marketing people have spent billions of dollars. They have it down to a total science. In fact,
sometimes they don't do it right.
No, well, they do and they don't. They still make mistakes, but the mistakes can depend, you know, they're not based on their science as much as they're based on what we call swag, you know, scientific wild guess, okay? And you know what the A stands for, all right? You have those marketers that are in the vein of a Sigmund Freud. They're going to work and tweak on the subconscious. I started to tell you I reproduce in my book, Mind Programming, parts of a training manual that were sent to me. That's actually an advertising training manual. And this training manual shows a couple of real ads that have appeared nationally everywhere that have, in one instance, death and dying themes, giant spiders and whatnot created in it to heighten anxiety. But they're also selling a product that is considered to be a product that can cause a death. And they sell an awful lot of those products. This is an old cigarette ad. The other one is a liquor ad, and that ad is full of sexual embeds. The overall theme of these two, both of them Freudian in their nature, is to heighten the sense of arousal, which increases, in advertising they say you have a third of a second to stop them and 3 seconds to read them.
Yeah.
So you it stops you, it creates that sense of arousal, and yet you don't know why this material is hidden in such a way that we think of it as subliminal. And at the same time that it's doing that, it's also creating a satisfaction. So it is building an anxiety, building a need, creating a fear, and then satisfying that need or that fear, all at an unconscious level. Then you have the straight-up stuff that comes at you. You know, the Marlboro Man, everybody wants to be a cowboy. The Gerber Baby, everybody loves
a little kid.
Yeah. But our situation, and we need that. You know, I mean, I have to. We do need marketing, so I'm not pounding on marketing. But what we as consumers need to do is realize that this is a very sophisticated science, and that we're being plied with it every day.
And what is amazing to me, Eldon, is the fact that we are being molded, and it seems to work.
It does work, and we are being molded. You know, I mean, look. And the molding can be really obvious. It can just stick you smack in the face. And lots of people will just know, just ignore it. Let me give you an example when you say that. And I know we got a break coming up.
30 seconds. Do you want to wait?
I'll wait till after the break because this is the National Security's Domestic Extremism Dictionary.
Oh, my gosh. And by the way, Mind Programming, where do you get it? Is it out?
Oh, the book is out. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, any brick-and-mortar bookstore, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million online. It's actually doing very well. The book club picked it up.
Oh, it's a great read.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
EldonTaylor.com is the website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. We'll be back in a moment as we talk about reverse speech, subliminal suggestions as well, mind control and brainwashing on Coast to Coast AM.